Welcome to the Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I am Mark Pettis and joined by my friend, colleague, John Bagnullo. John, good morning, my friend.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to see you, buddy.
Great to see you, as always. And we've been looking at a recently published paper that is a really interesting and I think unique study, John, and from the UK, that looked at women who were pregnant during, this is in the post-World War II era, and most of the early data from this study goes back to the early, I'd say 1950 to 1953. And this was part of what was a sugar-restricted environment in the UK, and I'm sure all around Europe in the post-World War II era. Yeah. And they looked at the health of those kids who were conceived at that time and who had very limited availability to sugar. And then they followed in the UK biobank data set what their health outcomes were later in life as compared to those kids who were conceived just a few years after the lifting of this restriction. We'll look at the changes in sugar consumption. They're quite dramatic, the before and after. And they'll go on to then measure differences in health outcomes of kids who were conceived. And for some, raised in those first 2 years of life with very limited sugar intake compared to those that had more of a contemporary ad lib, pretty high amount of sugar availability. And not surprisingly, those health outcomes decades later were quite different. And the study, I think, shines some light on what we would consider epigenetic effects, how the environment influences gene expression. And we appreciate today that there appear to be critical windows of environmental exposure for the developing fetus and early childhood that are just critical times for matching environment with gene, sort of healthy sort of gene compatibility. And this is a good example of the power of epigenetics, something that can happen at one point in time that can manifest decades later. And we have a few other examples of epigenetics that have very similar themes. So this is an interesting paper to look at.
Yeah, and you know, the one study that comes to mind, when you first shared this with me, I immediately thought, well, I thought of two things. One, I thought of obviously Weston Price's work with cats and different diets that cats were given during pregnancy and how it affected their litters and their offspring, which was, you know, again, that's 150 years, hard to believe, but, you know, we're talking like more than a century ago. At that point in time, you know, we didn't understand anything compared to the influence of that stage of life on development and in disease risk. But the other one, Mark, was one that you and I have talked about at some point in the past, which was a study done in Quebec, like following women and their children who were pregnant during the Great Ice Storm. Was that 99? Was that 1999 or 98? I forget which.
Yeah, I think it was. It was definitely the late 90s. I want to say 98. The Quebec ice storm.
Yeah, where people didn't have power and had different food supplies for months. Right, I think it was a really extended period of time, and obviously a lot of the women who were pregnant had limited food options or choices, and there was a lot more in the way of processed and refined foods, things that had high, long shelf lives, right? mostly everything was flour-based, high in sugar. And I think that, you know, again, I can't recall all of the details of the study, but I think it was a really good picture, not to the point that this paper is, much, you know, much greater amounts of data with this one that you brought to my attention and that we're going to talk about. But it was a similar, it was epigenetic study from, you know, a real different environment caused by that natural disaster and the people that were kind of captured in that. So it's incredible. It's incredible the difference it makes.
That's an awesome comparison, John. I actually have a slide that we'll share touching on that study. The lead investigator of that is at McGill. I don't know if he's still at McGill, but when this research is done, that's where he was. Moshe Siv. He's done a few really interesting epigenetic observational trials. And these studies are an important reminder to all of us of how traumatic environmental events, and in the cases of the sugar restriction after World War II, and in the case of the hunger and the limitation to mostly processed foods in the Quebec ice storm research data, is a kind of a sobering reminder for me that if you are, maybe you're experiencing an environmental catastrophe from a hurricane or tornado or an earthquake, you can see how large masses of people who are at sort of critical developmental stages and ages where the environment forces you into survival mode and often is accompanied by harsh restrictions and disruptions to everyday life, how enduring those effects can be. And I think, not to get too far off the mark here, but I think the pandemic, COVID, will prove to be an interesting landmark time period, particularly for young kids, women who were conceiving, carrying kids at that time, kids who were very young and in active development during that. It'll be interesting to see. And I think already there have been some early suggestions of very different trajectories of mental health, anxiety, you know, PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
You can begin to see some of these health manifestations presenting themselves around all of that. And it's probably going to be a while before we fully characterize that. But this current generation of young kids who are really impacted by that, it does make one wonder, what are the epigenetic signatures and how can one perhaps adapt their life moving forward to recalibrate those signatures? Because I think the beauty of epigenetics as we understand it currently is that while negative events can profoundly change gene expression, one can also introduce really positive environmental shifts, lifestyle shifts, mindset, belief shifts that can reprogram our DNA via epigenetics so that at the end of the day, when we don't become prisoners, lifetime prisoners of those events. And so it is good to sort of keep in mind that this needle can move both ways. But that's a great example, John, of additional research that very much corroborates the consequences, generational consequences.
Yeah, and you know, the only other thing that comes to mind other than that is something that we don't really have a lot of data with respect to, but we have these kind of observations that people made because it was so long ago, was the Great Potato Famine. and some of the influences that that had on Ireland and its population at that time. It was devastating, right? And you know, you've heard the accounts of whether they're family physicians, local doctors that we're seeing at that point in time. You know, a very kind of local population of patients, and then seeing their kids and then their grandkids, that it did have again, there were very long-standing effects of that massive food shortage and restrictions.
Yeah, well, this is a great segue for the study that we'll review, John. So I'm gonna pull up my slides here.
Excellent.
And hopefully you're able to see this okay,
yeah.
John.
Excellent. Thank you.
So this title of this study is Exposure to Sugar Rationing in the First 1,000 Days of Life Protected Against Chronic Disease. And this is kind of, really from my perspective, an all-star. These authors, come from the Rand Corp, McGill. We'll look at Moshe Sif's research from McGill, not related to this study. University of Chicago, UC Berkeley, there's some heavy hitters here looking at this data. And what the study showed, this was a landmark study, just to provide a synopsis, that was published in Science, revealed that restricting sugar intake during the first 1,000 days of life, so this is from conception through a child's second birthday, significantly lowered the risk of developing chronic diseases like type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure in adulthood. And this really was, as you sort of pointed out, John, this is sort of nature's way of creating a study. This was a historical time of great significance. The UK ended its wartime sugar rationing in September of 1953. So from the post-World War II period, 45, through that several-year period, there were significant restrictions. And when the rationing stopped, what we'll see, and we'll show a graphic from this study, the public sugar consumption almost doubled overnight. It immediately went up. So it really did create this sort of control group. And adults then, through this UK biobank, who were born at those times, could be compared over, the following generation or two. And so during the rationing period, the sugar caps really closely matched the current recommendations, which I'll share briefly here. But that was under 40 grams daily. And this is added sugar per day for adults, very little for children, and none for toddlers under the age of two. So this rationing sort of forced what today we would consider a compliance with optimal recommendations, if in fact they're optimal. One could say that for some, any dose of sugar could be problematic. And so these are just the core findings, and then we'll look at some of the graphic representation. There were thousands of people included in this study, and the lowest disease risk were those kids who were conceived and experienced their first 2 years of life post-conception. So that's like a 3-year, 1,000-day prospective experience of rationing. Those kids later in life had the lowest risks of type 2 diabetes and hypertension, 35% lower risk compared to those kids who were conceived and after birth had more normal sugar intake by current standards, and also had a 20% lower risk of hypertension. The other thing that they saw in this study John, is that in addition to having lower risks of those particular diseases later in life, for those who would eventually be diagnosed with type 2 diabetes or hypertension, there was a delay in onset by 4 years for diabetes, 2 years for hypertension. And so, as we'll see, there was a group of kids who were conceived before the end of the ration, but after birth, the ration was lifted. So we also have this intermediate group, John, of people who were restricted for part of their development and less restricted as part of it, sort of an intermediate group. And you really do see kind of a dose response here. They have risk reduction, but not of the magnitude that those that were completely restricted versus those that had no restriction at all. And so being exposed to a low sugar diet while in the womb accounted for about a third of the risk reduction. And it was quite clear that additional benefits occurred when that restriction continued after birth. And in this example, for 2 years after birth, but we know those early infancy year, you know, months and year or two are really critical from an epigenetic perspective.
And it's interesting, Mark, we don't have the data. I looked to see if there was any discussion of it, but this is simply sugar, added sugar, this, you know, this restriction. So it doesn't really get into the broader category of carbohydrates. I mean, again, that's a different time in the world. There weren't going to be quite as many refined carbohydrates outside of the sugar world, right? I mean, there would be bread and there would still be some things made with flour, but it was a much cleaner landscape, so to speak, with refined carbs. But, you know, I just think it speaks to the impact that this very simple sugar restriction had. But you can imagine, you know, what the findings could be if you expanded that to carbohydrate restriction, especially carbohydrate restriction from refined sources, right? I mean, but that being said, these are still powerful findings.
For sure. And this graph demonstrates the significant intake in sugar that occurs when this rationing ends in September of 1953. Most of these other, doesn't quite address what you were commenting on, John, but when you look at protein fat intake, pretty consistent, some fluctuation, but clearly the biggest variable of change before versus after the rationing was in with respect to added sugar intake. And this is just a reminder for folks where the current guidelines are. And debate as one will, these are the current guidelines with respect to added sugar. So the general daily limit is to keep added sugars under 10% of your total daily calories. You know, I don't know how many Americans would have a sense of what 10% of their total daily calories are and then how to convert that to sugar. But this is how our guidelines are articulated. So that's about 50 grams or 12 teaspoons of sugar, added sugar, for someone on a 2,000 calorie diet, which is still sort of considered an average caloric intake. It's kind of like what we were talking about, John, of the average body weight of 70 kilograms, you know, which is this meme, which might have been true two generations ago, but no longer.
I think the same for the standard
2,000 calorie diet. But anyhow, not to pontificate, but and then meal-based targets, which would be included in this total sort of cap, you know, that individual meals contain no more than 10 grams or 2 teaspoons of added sugar. The Heart Association has been a little more strict, good for them. And isn't it interesting that the Heart Association is coming down harder on sugar after having pretty much ignored it for, you know, the last 50 years with its emphasis on fat. But they recommend tighter caps of, you know, 25 grams a day for women, 36 grams a day for men. And children, you know, I don't know of any pediatrician out there that would not highly recommend avoidance of sugar, particularly in those toddler age kids. It's just it may seem like nothing day to day, but really, when you start talking epigenetics, you've got to be thinking of how something you do and 2026 will impact how you are in 2050, right? I mean, that's not typically how humans are wired.
It's not
out of
the mind, right?
And so this is a graphic of the study, John, and this really speaks to sort of the methodology. And again, this sugar restricted rationing was into the 1950s, the early 1950s. So there were kids that they studied that got rationed during the entire 1,000 days of life from conception, the entire fetal development, and then post-birth. And then if you were born around 53, you may have had some rationing during in utero development, but you're born at a time when the rationing ends, and so you get more sugar during early childhood, maybe not as much in utero. And then the cohort, or some might call a natural control group, where you know, they're conceived in 54, they get full sort of sugar exposure, as the graph depicted earlier, what would be sort of typical modern day sugar intake, all during conception forward and early childhood forward. And again, they just looked at that 1,000 days, John. The other thing the study didn't attempt to do is to see what would happen if those restrictions were even longer. There probably were some kids in the late 40s that they didn't capture. And we know that many adults who never had rationing of sugar for their entire lives, you could imagine those even being stratified further toward greatest risk. But this is just it's a really interesting design of how to sort of cut this data and analyze it. And then when you look years out, right? So these were kids born in the early 50s, mid late 50s, you know, which is sort of this boomer demographic. Most of these adults today are, you know, would be in their 60s plus. And you do see these dramatic differences between full rationing, being lifted. So these were just high sugar intake during conception and during those first 2 years of life. This is that intermediate group that had partial restriction during in utero development, but ad lib sugar intake in early childhood. And then those with the greatest risk reduction, and here, you know, hazard ratios of, you know, are quite different here. These are all statistically significant for those that were restricted through conception, fetal development, and those first 2 years of life. And so those are really compelling differences in disease prevalence. And then this is a very similar curve for hypertension. And again, no rationing at all with the highest risk of hypertension later in life. rationing in utero, but not in early childhood. Again, you see this dose response that I think adds even more credence to the connections being raised here in this study. And then, of course, those that had full rationing with much lower hypertension risk later in life. And so these are clearly interesting trends. And then this is just another way of depicting this this data with respect to risk reduction in those with rationing being greatest for type 2 diabetes and hypertension. And so
yeah, making a really clear picture here in terms of the genes that get turned on with that.
Yeah, no, no question.
Windows of exposure, you know, probably 80% of that is insulin driven, right?
Yes. And, you know, it, we've talked some about Randy Jertl's work. He was at Duke at the time that he did this. I think he's, he might be at Vanderbilt now. And his work was with the agouti mouse. The agouti mouse is the most common animal model of type 2 diabetes. They have a genetic mutation. This is a dominant genetic mutation. So the offspring of the agouti mouse generally, you know, will get this mutation and manifest what all agouti mice do. They get very large. They get typical Western human chronic complex diseases from diabetes, obesity, cancers. They don't navigate the maze very well. They probably have cognitive issues as well. And they have this sort of a golden yellow fur. And so Jertl, during pregnancy of these agouti mice, gave them nutrients, B vitamins, choline, nutrients known to methylate this epigenetic effect of adding a methyl group. And the offspring of this agouti mice that got the methylating agents were protected. They did not get as large. They did not get diabetes or obesity or hypertensive. They had far fewer cancers. And the color of the fur, which was being seen for the first time, went from this yellowish color to a gray color. And so this was kind of a revelation that Jertl was finding. And the offspring of the agouti mice, which looked like, and they were like an entirely different mouse, had the mutation. It's not like they didn't inherit the mutation, this agouti mutation. Instead, what they found was that the mutation was inherited, but there was now more methylation around that mutation, which had the effect of silencing the expression of that agouti gene. And so Jertl was one of the first to show that you could epigenetically, and in this instance, silence a dominant gene, creating a different offspring. And not shown here, but when this generation of offspring had children, they maintained this phenotype. So the silencing of the gene from the original mom continued in further offspring. And so very significant demonstration in animals of how this critical time of pregnancy and how environment, in this example, nutritional environment, could totally change the trajectory of health of the offspring. And that had an intergenerational effect. And it'll be interesting to see, John, if you were to look at the offspring of the kids who were born after sugar restriction, So those 50-year-old kids from the UK, adults in the UK who were restricted as infants, what did their offspring look like? What was their risk of hypertension and diabetes? Yeah. Probably enough time has gone by that they can begin to get some data there. One might hypothesize some continued risk reduction in those generations from that original study. And again, these are this was just a striking example of nutritional epigenetics.
Yeah, it'll also
and this
be
was the study that you were referring to,
John. Yeah, yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
I'm sorry, John, you were going to say something?
Well, yeah, no, this is that's absolutely the study that I mentioned earlier. And the other thing is I'll be curious to see how long it is before researchers start to look at disease risk in children born of mothers using GLP-1 drugs. And I say that because while I think most people are aware of the short-term benefits of GLP-1 drugs in terms of the dramatic weight loss, you know, with the use of those comes a significant reduction in the quantity of food eaten by most users. And I think there's some preliminary evidence that shows there are a handful of nutrients that are typically missing. You know, we know that the GLP-1, that category of medications, when it reduces appetites, there's certain foods that seem to be the first to kind of fall out of the diet. And, you know, some studies there have shown, you know, that there's a significant percentage of women who are nutrient deficient, one or more nutrients. So I'm just thinking, you know, it'll be interesting to see if we think about, you know, the genes that we know are controlled by, whether it's methylation or sulfation. There's, there's some of those processes that are very nutrient dependent. It'll be interesting to see how it influences the health of the children of mothers using GLP-1 drugs. I think, again, not from a sugar reduction in sugar perspective, there may be some of that that's favorable with GLP-1, but I think that the nutrient deficiencies, I looked at zinc, for instance, and I know some GLP-1 users try to supplement and cover their bases with multivitamins and things like that, but it's never the same as eating a nutrient-dense diet. So I just bring that up because it's going to be another like window of time when this is like exploded, right? GLP-1 use has just exploded here in the last couple years. So I think there'll be a line of demarcation, much like you walked us through with that study done with sugar restriction. It'll be fascinating to see how nutrient deficiencies that occur with GLP-1 use, how does that influence, disease risk? I think someday we'll have that data. I know it's a bit of a tangent there. Sorry.
Indeed. these are fascinating times. I'm sort of reminded by your comment, John, that we're all sort of canaries in the coal mine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Polypharmacy and new to nature interventions that some of which may have obvious benefits, some of which, history would suggest unintended consequences almost always accompany new inputs.
Yeah.
And they can be very hard to predict. We were talking about Moshe Shiv's research at McGill, and this was in reference to the Quebec ice storm that you had commented on, John, at the outset.
Yeah.
And this was back in the late 90s. And Siv, being a neuroscientist and very interested in epigenetics, they looked at women who were pregnant, carrying babies during this ice storm where there was a significant deprivation. Several weeks of ice, the roads, the usual supply chains were profoundly disrupted. So over a very short time, there was a sudden drop in availability of food. Obviously, very significant stresses, right? The hypothalamic pituitary fight flight response. One could imagine that being a very significant pervasive biologic landscape. So he had the wherewithal to see an opportunity to collect some very meaningful data here. And so they did many measures of metabolic health on the moms at that time. And they had historical controls, of course, who were carrying before the ice storm. And looked at, once these kids were born, what was the health of these children like, particularly with respect to metabolic health? So were these kids overweight? Were they dealing with insulin resistance, blood pressure, sort of the usual suspects? And this was the original publication in 2014. And basically, this was the first evidence in humans that perinatal maternal stress resulted in a lasting, broad, and functionally organized DNA methylation signature in several tissues in the offspring. It was as if, John, and many people might think of epigenetics as a kind of a biologic indication of what the conditions of the environment are for the species inhabiting that environment. Mm-hmm. So if mom is carrying her child and the signals from the environment are, your baby is about to enter a harsh environment of deprivation, of challenge, might it make sense for the DNA of that child in utero to be reset in a way that would better prepare that child for a harsh environment? That, which essentially means a lower threshold for fight flight, a more active immune system. We might call that inflammation or autoimmunity. And so those epigenetic changes, probably adaptive to assist in the survival for that generation of offspring. But once that those harsh environmental conditions are lifted, as was the case in this ice storm after several weeks, if that genetic programming isn't recalibrated, that child will continue to have a fight flight pro sort of inflammatory hypervigilant immune and all that comes with it, mitochondrial gut biome. So that's sort of the thinking here, and that's what they found in the most of these kids that were in this original publication were school age, and more of them were overweight, more of them had episodes of anxiety. And so you could see the phenotype, the biology expressing in these offspring. Now, what I didn't include here, John, and this is just really brilliant research, 'cause this was now over 10 years ago, Moshe Siv and his lab at McGill continued to follow these kids into young adulthood. And many of these changes persisted. John, these weren't just early childhood manifestations. They were persisting into early adulthood. And so again, if that now young adult isn't mindful of their biologic predisposition for storing excess calories, having been conceived at a time of deprivation, insulin resistance, all of the things that they're programmed for, if they're not in some way reprogrammed. And I think that's, to even talk about reprogramming of human biology is kind of a, you know, that that research is there. You know, David Sinclair's work, a lot of people looking at epigenetic programming, it's quite clear that, and this is the whole, I think, beauty of this sort of moving beyond this being a prisoner of your DNA to being largely programmed by events of early life and early childhood, and the ability in instances where that programming is not serving us well to look at rewriting the software. And so Siv showed that in the absence of some rewriting of the software, these changes continue into adulthood. And that's kind of what the biobank study that we started with was suggesting, because many of these people are, you know, in their 50s and 60s now. This, and I just wanted to share this, John. It's a little bit of a digression, but this is also research from Siv. And a lot of this work was reproduced by the late Bruce McEwen at the Rockefeller Institute. And they looked at, this was in humans, with respect to children who committed suicide. And not surprisingly, these were children that had horribly traumatic childhoods, pervasive abuse. As young adults, they become overwhelmed. They take their lives. And what Siv was able to do through autopsy, he looked at the brain tissue of these children with a focus on the stress response, the glucocorticoid, the fight-flight response in the brain. And he found complete disruption in the glucocorticoid receptor gene, the receptor protein function, so that these now young adults were not signaling the fight-flight. Ordinarily, our cortisol would get to a certain level and it would feed back to our pituitary and say, enough is enough, you can turn that off. There was a failure to maintain that feedback response in these young adults who committed suicide with very traumatic upbringing. Now, he compared that to young adults, similar ages, similar gender, that died of traumatic events, usually car accidents, falls. And these were adults that had very different upbringings of having two parents in the home, loving parents, having, you know, what they needed. There was no traumatic sort of deprivations. And they had a very normal glucocorticoid gene expression receptor response. And so you see very different epigenetic effects in this example on the basis of the sort of the psychosocial upbringing of these children. And we know, right, we know that bonding in early childhood may be one of the strongest from the standpoint of epigenetic effects. Unconditional love, some might say, not to get too sort of mystical, but, you know, unconditional love it may be the strongest expression in this three-dimensional environment that we are in, from the perspective, energetic, the frequency, energetic, the vibratory, the energetic effects of this, the quantum effects. There is absolutely no substitute for this.
I was thinking that, Mark. This is in essence the mechanism behind the quantum physics, right, of love. It's incredible.
It's incredible. And you can measure the material effects of that by way of methylation patterns in DNA, and then ultimately how that affects your ability to manage stress. Just as you can look at environments where, you know, just horrible trauma, complete lack of love, very little support, complete deprivation, just undoing the biologic ability to navigate that environment, and the consequences of that are quite apparent for all of us to see in modern life. But Siv was able to draw that. And, you know, one of the things that I love about sort of evolutionary biology, John, and is, you know, humans are mammals. And when you know, all mammals have this, what separates all mammals from all non-mammals is the capacity for love and bonding. All mammals bond. All mammals have a separation cry, some language or communication that allows child to call mom when in need of that. And we know that these have powerful neuroscientific effects. I wrote a lot about this stuff in a book that came out 20 years ago, John, called It's All in Your Head.
Yeah.
It was a look at some of the early epigenetics of neuro development and how we can cultivate. The whole premise of the book was the science suggesting that one could cultivate. We become the sort of the artists of the canvas that we're painting in this experience of life, and that, you know, being sort of prisoners of our DNA is no longer the case. And we see this. This is just another example of if you look at nothing other than the carbohydrate glycemic response. We talk about this all the time, John. And again, this is some of the earliest epigenetic research. These were adults that consumed a lot of high glycemic carbs, sort of the standard American diet. And after 4 weeks, if you do a biopsy of abdominal fat, stick a little needle in there and grab a little fat sample, then you look at the epigenetics, you see after 4 weeks, this radical upregulation, changes in methylation patterns that are linked to more oxidative stress, inflammation. You take those same adults and without lowering their calories, so this is eucaloric, without lowering their carbohydrate intake, so it's the same proportion of carbs, the only thing you're manipulating is the glycemic effect of the carbohydrate. 4 weeks later, you look at this gene expression, they all move the other way. And that's over a four-week period. So this was an example of how changing nothing other than the glycemic effect of the carbohydrate you're consuming can totally rewrite your gene expression. And I don't know how it is, John, that research like this doesn't end up on front page news, but this is just some additional corroborating study looking at pregnant lactating women when they were consuming more sugar. Most infants and toddlers, would consume more as, again, they're sort of biologically now predisposed. And the last thing I want to mention here, John, I'm a big fan of Gary Taubes.
Yeah, great,
he's an investigative journalist. And we often comment tongue-in-cheek on how some of the best research are from non-scientists, right. That are just very, they educate themselves, they learn how to interpret the scientific literature, they interview people who are at the vanguard of very sometimes controversial research, controversial because it challenges the conventional wisdom. And I've come to appreciate the value of great investigative journalism. And from Gary and Nina Teicholz and many others in this field, his original book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, more recently, The Case Against Sugar, Rethinking Diabetes. When your grant support and your livelihood isn't contingent on your thoughts, as it is for so many academicians, you get a less filtered and I think a bit more objective overview. And Taubes does it really, really well. I highly recommend his Substack. And he's just a great writer, and he's very thoughtful. And I think I just think he deserves a lot of credit. And he wrote about this study, which is what got me to think about it in a recent Substack post that he did. And so I just want to put this out there for those that may not be familiar with his work. Yeah. This is you'll know more than most scientists that spend their whole life studying metabolism after reading these than certainly most physicians, in my humble objective opinion. So the bottom line, right, John, the choices we make matter. They matter a lot. And the choices we make don't just influence ourselves. They influence those we love. And the choices we make at particular times in our lives appears to be even more critical. And so this research is a really powerful reminder that things in our environment that we would consider staples are still relatively new to the human species in the abundance that they exist in the persistence year round that they consist in. And then, as we always say, John, you know, we're just looking at one thing here, sugar, right. But when we look at bonding and love and you know, pick your movement and
Sunlight, you start sunlight, stacking them on top right? of
when
each
you
other.
You start stacking these things. Yeah. You're talking about a complete engineering of gene expression that can either be working for you in modern life or making modern life much more challenging. The time frame over which one can begin to re-engineer is much shorter than I think people would ever imagine, John.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope our listeners see this as the power of change, regardless of whether you're an infant, an adult, or even in your later years. It's profound. And we talk about all the different inputs that we have control over them, right? Whether it's love, whether it's light exposure, obviously, here looking at the quality of carbohydrates. But it's incredible that you can see the results that, there might not be as easily captured as they would be with a study, but people that you and I have worked with in their 50s that really observe dramatic differences in biochemical pathways with, a change in some of those inputs.
Definitely. Well, it's been a pleasure as always sharing, and we hope that if this content is helpful, please share with your friends and family the slide deck and this primary article that we referenced, open source article, will be available on our website, healthedgepodcast.com. John, I'm going to be off the radar next week. My daughter is getting married on Saturday, and we're just going to be sort of fully immersed in that over the next several days. And so we'll have next week off, and then I hope that we can reconvene 2 weeks.
I look forward to it. Yeah, I look forward to having an amazing wedding and time with family, Mark.
Thank you, John. That's what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
That's why we're here, and grateful for that. Grateful for you, John, and I love you, brother, and you be well.
Mark.
Enjoy this beautiful fall season.
You as well, Mark. Love you.
Take care.